Arsenal for Democracy is available twice a week. There's a free episode at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple or Stitcher each weekend, and a midweek bonus episode at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy, available for $5 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stunt Bird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 362, recorded on Sunday, April 4th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line, as always, from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
This week's episode returns to some core themes of our program: central planning and economic administration in an industrial economy using new technology, and the political values or outcomes of technological systems. In this case, in an echo of our episodes on paper, typing, and printing advances of the Second Industrial Revolution, we'll be talking specifically at great depth about a demonstration of similar principles at the dawn of the Third Industrial Revolution, the unfinished Project CyberSyn program in Chile during the Democratic Socialist government of 1970 to 1973. As we covered in our recent episode on the Church Committee, that political experiment ended in a violent U.S.-backed military coup. But before then, a small circle of Chilean engineers, planners, and politicians were engaged in an ambitious plan to design and build, with very limited physical capital resources, a 1970s national computing network to assist in leftist economic planning without a violent revolution. It never really got a chance to prove itself before being literally destroyed after the coup, but it's one of the big what-ifs of the history of leftist political and economic experiments thwarted by U.S. intervention. Now, Rachel, could you talk to us a little bit more, as you started to on the Frank Church episode, about some background on Salvador Allende's government and the political situation when he took power in 1970?
Yeah. So for some background, Salvador Allende Gossens was a medical doctor who became a socialist at 24 because during his university education and his medical education, he saw the plight of the poor. He co-founded a branch of the Socialist Party in his hometown and quickly rose through the ranks of the party. He was elected to Congress in 1937 and was named Minister of Health in 1939. He was elected to the Senate in 1945. He ran for president in 1952, 58, 64, and finally 1970. He won a plurality of votes in a three-way race in September 1970, running as the popular Unity candidate, narrowly edging out the right-wing former president Jorge Alessandri. So the Popular Unity Party coalition comprised a coalition of the Chilean left, the Socialist Party, Communist Party, Radical Party, Social Democrat Party, the Independent Popular Action, and the MAPU, Movimiento de Acción Popular Unitario. So they all came together to back Allende. The Constitution stated that in the case of no majority winner, Congress voted between the two candidates with the most votes, so Allende and Alessandri. So Allende allied with the Christian Democrats because they were a party that also backed structural, social, and economic change. So at this point, between the presidential election and Congress voting on the winner, the capitalist class went into overdrive trying to prevent Allende from assuming office. Nixon met with Henry Kissinger, Pepsi-Cola chairman Donald Kendall, Attorney General John Mitchell, and Augustin Edwards, who was the owner of a right-wing newspaper in Chile called El Mercurio, and also a Pepsi-Cola bottling plant. Edwards basically asked the Nixon administration to assist in efforts to stop Allende from becoming president. And as we discussed in the Frank Church episode, the CIA and ITT were involved in the assassination of General René Schneider, who believed that the role of the Chilean military was solely to protect Chile's sovereignty and that they should stay out of politics and not participate in any potential coup. So Allende assumed the presidency in November 1970 with the support of the Christian Democrats in Congress. The USA continued to interfere with Chile, creating a, quote, invisible economic blockade and spending $8 million on initiatives destabilizing the Allende government. Allende really wanted to implement change through democratic processes, not by force, not by a violent revolution. He wanted to use popular sentiment to push through economic and social reforms. It would be a revolution with a taste of, quote, red wine and empanadas. So this is kind of the background and setup to his presidential administration.
So we're going to be talking today, as I said, about Project CyberSyn, or in Spanish, it was known as Proyecto Cinco, for Sistema de Información y Control. And the book I read for this episode, which I highly recommend, it's short, but it's very dense, and we are going to be summarizing it at great length in terms of points that felt salient to us, but there's a lot more in it if you actually can get a hold of a copy, although it's not easy to do. I had to get the library to special order a copy printed for me. This book is called Cybernetic Revolutionaries, Technology and Politics in Allende's Chile by Eden Medina, MIT Press 2011. It's a fascinating look at the Allende years in Chile through a very specific narrow lens that gives us a lot of unusual insights into that period, sometimes even down to the day-by-day events. It covers a project that involved some of the people from Allende's inner circle, but was never really a core part of the peaceful revolution in Chile or the Allende government, which gives the reader a new window into the big picture things happening around it. And interestingly, as noted in the epilogue, one of the highest-level members of the Allende government, Mining Minister Sergio Bitar, wrote a semi-official insider account in the mid-1980s of what had gone wrong inside the Chilean Revolution as opposed to the external factors of the coup and U.S. interference, and he used cybernetic theories, which we'll be talking about in just a moment, to explain his analysis, which he had gathered from Project CyberSyn leaders when he was imprisoned together with them after the coup, and they were all together reflecting on everything that had happened. Rachel, if you want to read the summary from the back of the book, just to give a further overview of what this book is about before we get into the details, that would be great.
In Cybernetic Revolutionaries, Eden Medina tells the history of two intersecting utopian visions, one political and one technological. The first was Chile's experiment with peaceful socialist change under Salvador Allende. The second was a simultaneous attempt to build a computer system that would manage Chile's economy. Neither vision was fully realized. Allende's government ended with a violent military coup. The system, known as Project CyberSyn, was never completely implemented, but they hold lessons for today about the relationship between technology and politics. Drawing on extensive archival material and interviews, Medina examines the cybernetic system envisioned by the Chilean government, which was to feature holistic system design, decentralized management, human-computer interaction, a national telex network, near real-time control of the growing industrial sector, and modeling the behavior of dynamic systems. She also describes, and documents with photographs, the network's Star Trek-like operations room, which featured swivel chairs with armrest control panels, a wall of screens displaying data, and flashing red lights to indicate economic emergencies.
The book is based on more than 50 interviews with people connected in some way to the project and on the personal files and records of four people. It was researched over more than a decade. So let's go through some of the key points that I wanted to highlight from this book. There was a lot of things we could have talked about, and we had to kind of narrow it down, and this is still going to be a long episode regardless. Rachel, could you read the quote from the preface that kind of gives the author's take on this?
Nor was Project CyberSyn just any technological system. It was conceived as a real-time control system capable of collecting economic data throughout the nation, transmitting it to the government, and combining it in ways that could assist decision-making. That was at a time when the U.S. ARPANET, the predecessor of the Internet, was still in its infancy, and the most technologically advanced nations of the developed world were still trying to build large-scale real-time control systems.
In fact, the Soviet Union had already tried and failed to build a national computer system for managing a planned economy, which mostly failed for political turf war reasons.
By 1970, Chile had approximately 50 computers installed in the government and the private sector, most of which were out of date, whereas approximately 48,000 general-purpose computers were installed in the United States at the time. However, those involved in Project CyberSyn believed that cybernetics, the interdisciplinary post-war science of communication and control, would allow them to create a cutting-edge system that used Chile's existing technological resources.
Now, as Rachel just mentioned, there were not a whole lot of computers in Chile at the time. Now, I think it's fair to note that Chile's economy and population were relatively small, especially if we're comparing it to, say, the United States at the time. Chile had fewer than 10 million residents in 1970, and it did have actually a decent level of computer literacy among both private corporate administrators and the state administration. But it was nonetheless quite small. If you look at the U.S. Commonwealth of Puerto Rico at the same time, which had only 2.7 million residents, they had about 300 computers to Chile's 50. In Chapter 2, the author emphasizes that the preceding presidential administration under the Christian Democrats had not only begun laying groundwork for industry nationalization, but more importantly for this specific subject, they had been laying important groundwork for the Chilean state to be heavily involved in computer mainframe technology and incorporating it into the administration of the state and, by extension, the state-owned economic sectors, which the Christian Democrats also favored. But the Christian Democrats had used computers to crunch numbers faster and prepare annual reports, not for real-time feedback or modeling scenarios. The Christian Democrat government also found itself unable to acquire multiple mainframes for reasons relating to supply and international credit. So those limiting factors pushed Chile in the direction of centralization of computing resources rather than a more distributed network we would be more familiar with today. When the Allende government launched Project CyberSyn, they not only inherited computer resources nearly all already in public hands before they had taken power, but also inherited public computer resources centralized to one entity rather than multiple ministries. The author also discusses, at several points in the book, the role of IBM Chile, but I figured I would leave that for people to read the book themselves, since we had to pick and choose what we were emphasizing. As noted earlier, the prototype control room for Project CyberSyn looks sort of like a Star Trek deck. That's at least the back of the book comparison. The author actually uses the comparison of 2001: A Space Odyssey from 1968. And this was intended to display macroeconomic data for the entire nation, with eventual specific control rooms in various ministries and offices focused on narrower data related to their own portfolios. It's important to note from the appendix of the book that the project originally only included data from four national economic categories relevant to one area of the government and completely left out the huge copper mining and agricultural sectors because they were under the oversight of other ministries, and the project never got as far as government-wide implementation. Allende, along with a military general, personally visited the prototype control room just over 2 years into his presidency and less than a year before his assassination. Unfortunately, he didn't really get to see much on the tour because the electronics were overheated and malfunctioning, which does kind of feel like a metaphor for the project in a lot of ways. Again, this is basically just a big what if, because it really never got far enough to actually prove itself in any real sense. There were certain elements of it, as we'll discuss, that were able to sort of start to prove themselves, but in terms of the overall project and certainly the control room, that was not ever at that point. Now, the book has, in addition to a prologue and a preface, has an intro chapter. I guess that's chapter zero. And that covers what are cybernetics, which is, you know, the point, the title is Cybernetic Revolutionaries, and this is a cybernetic project. And that's sort of a weird concept, so we have to talk a little bit about that. So cybernetics can be hard to define, especially because it's so heavily interdisciplinary and has often faded into its applied disciplines more than it has stood alone. But it basically seeks to take lessons from natural biological systems of control and communication, which are, of course, far more highly advanced than any computer networks even today, and apply them via technology to social, political, economic, and other types of systems. So, for example, the human nervous system and how it provides holistic feedback to the brain, as noted in Chapter 1 of the book, was a theoretical inspiration for the concept of Project CyberSyn in Chile. Early examples of cybernetic research, as far back as World War II, were concerned with figuring out how to rapidly and automatically process incoming feedback information and make corrections faster than a person, such as an airplane pilot or aircraft gunner can, although it took a while for the technology to catch up with the theory. The author argues that Project CyberSyn represents the fusion of two utopian projects, building a democratic socialist political economy within the constitutional order, and that was a very important stipulation because that had been a condition for Congress to confirm Allende's election in the first place, and secondly, building an internet for real-time control decades ahead of the curve. The constitutional promises were at the heart of the Allende project, as a whole and represented a continuity with Chile's tradition up to that point of the longest uninterrupted chain of peaceful democratic transitions of power in Latin America from 1932 until the coup in 1973. This could have, had it been allowed to succeed, opened a new Chilean model independent of the two superpowers during the Cold War. But for that to be a success, Allende needed to develop a better means of managing the rapidly growing state-owned sectors and all their public employees, as well as to overcome the economic challenges being thrown in its path daily by U.S. covert operations, both domestically in Chile and on the global financial and trade markets. It was hoped that, in addition to accumulating and processing data from around the country, software simulators of the economy would allow central planners to test the potential implications of making various policy changes before doing so. Had it gotten beyond the prototype phase instead of being interrupted by the military coup in 1973, some of the project designers hoped to include workers at the bottom levels of the economy in developing the software models to avoid the project being purely top-down control. The author emphasizes that the Project CyberSyn participants, who were generally white-collar professionals in the technology field, did not view themselves as apolitical technocrats, but rather as attempting to harness technology to achieve explicit political aims and change society, not just tinker with the economy. But they didn't all necessarily agree on those exact political goals, and of course the situation changed as the political situation in the country deteriorated in the run-up to the military coup. So now we have to take a little bit of a side detour here, although it's a central figure in the book. There were a lot of people we could have talked about in this book if we had more time, and you should read the book, but we really can't do this topic without talking about Stafford Beer. He was a British cybernetics theoretician who had been working in the field since 1956 when he joined the major UK company United Steel and launched a computer research department aimed at developing operational management cybernetics, i.e., computer-assisted management of company operations, basically as an extension of scientific management theories from the earlier 20th century. In the 1960s, he was consulting in the field of cybernetics. In mid-1971, he was invited by the Chilean Production Development Corporation under the Allende government to come down to Chile to consult on applying cybernetics to state-owned industries. He hoped that the project in Chile would ultimately allow national economic management decisions to be devolved all the way down the chain to the most local level of control with and perhaps by the workers. And he believed that the devolution of power was also the broader political objective of the Allende government and the movement behind it. And that's cited from his personal papers in the book. After the coup, he did a combination of consulting and teaching, but eventually returned to democratic control potential in cybernetics in the 1990s when he developed a method of problem solving and decision making in small teams without hierarchy. This was a trademarked consulting method that he called Syntegrity. He also coined the phrase, "The purpose of a system is what it does," to refer to the difference of the results any system delivers as contrasted with its purported intentions by its creators and its operators. I thought that was a really interesting concept, a very cool way of thinking about things. It basically describes systems bluntly as they are, not as they claim to be. Again, that concept is called "The purpose of a system is what it does." So the book, in the intro and chapter one, essentially argues that Stafford Beer was recruited specifically because his theoretical work at the time was focusing on trying to resolve the paradox of maintaining stability while undertaking structural changes to a system, which matched the government's broad socio-political goals, and he had shown interest in balancing autonomous decision-making with system cohesion. It's still a bit vague as to how Stafford Beer thought the system might work in terms of that balance and his opposition to quote-unquote bureaucracy, but also continued opposition to unaccountable authoritarianism. I personally was reminded of the early Russian revolutionaries endlessly denouncing bureaucracy as the source of economic incompetence and sluggishness under the Tsar's regime shortly before instituting one of the world's largest bureaucracies, out of recognition that on some level it was necessary to the operations of the state. The author implies that Beer might have been more fixated on the optics of a Churchill meets sci-fi war room style control room setup with chairs, buttons, and color TVs, rather than on the actual details of his system of governance assisted by cybernetics. Beer did not view his system concept as hierarchical, which became important when public opinion and the media caught wind of this project. High-level decision makers, according to his idea of this, would set the broad strokes of policy for the long-range future based on both external inputs and data filtering upward, and they would step in to sort out emergencies the lower-level people had been unable to resolve internally or laterally. But conversely, lower-level day-to-day decision-makers would have to make their daily choices based in part on information and strategies being handed down to them. Neither the high-level people nor the low-level people can really do their jobs and make adjustments without responding to continuous feedback from the other. And neither can do their jobs if they are all overwhelmed by more information than they can handle. He also emphasized lateral and diagonal communications across departments, ministries, and companies, and even individual factories, so that managers could come up with creative solutions to problems without having to go up and down a bureaucratic chain of command to make contact outside their own immediate sphere. And he wanted to implement an emergency system for the people at ground level to alert people at the very top of a serious problem if they weren't getting a response, to avoid it being filtered out of view. Again, I found that to be a bit vague, and I think the author did as well. Beer, like the Chilean socialists in government, emphasized that the top level of his ideal system was essentially reserved for the people making quote-unquote values decisions. You don't want those people bogged down in the daily minutiae of production quotas and outputs. You want them charting the course for the nation overall based on values, in this case, socialism, and then the other levels of the system should figure out how to implement those values. And when those values conflicted with each other at the lower levels, the top-level political actors would decide who or what to sacrifice to maintain systemic stability and the overall vision. In Chapter 2, Beer is quoted as describing a state of quote-unquote overstability to describe a system that is so stable that it is immovable in the face of changing circumstances or conditions, which is not compatible with self-regulation survival mechanisms of true homeostasis. Again, you can see the biological comparisons being made in cybernetic theory here. Homeostasis, like keeping your body temperature regulated and things like that. You know, there's a certain amount of flexibility that you need and a certain amount of stability, but you don't want to be totally, you know, immovable one way or the other, and you don't want to be totally volatile either. The book also suggests that Beer came from an unusual branch of the field of cybernetics, which was civilian industrial management consulting in theory, rather than literally coming from the military or military-funded research in academia. The author notes that just before the Chilean project, the biggest usages of similar national data feedback systems were things like U.S. Defense Secretary Robert McNamara trying to track the political situation in Vietnam by local political division in real time so he could wage the Vietnam War more efficiently. There were some civilian cybernetics projects in the U.S. around things like urban planning, but overwhelmingly, it was being used either inside the military or in military-funded research settings. Beer was also recruited to the Chilean project because his consultancy in the 1960s had been contracted with the Chilean steel and rail industries, although he was not personally involved in the work there. And a local student involved in the work ended up later in one of the positions responsible for nationalizing industries under Allende. By coincidence, in 1970, the year he was recruited, Beer was delivering speeches on the need for peaceful systems revolutions without violence or anarchy, because systems of government were not evolving fast enough to cope with a changing world. But the politicians in Chile were actually not aware of these speeches at the time he was recruited. It just happened to strengthen the compatibility of his personal vision with their movement's aims. The author states that Beer was not a Marxist, but was aligned more or less with the Fabian socialist tradition within the UK Labour Party, which meant that he shared similar tactical and structural thinking, although not necessarily precisely the same ideology as the Allende government when he arrived in Chile in 1971. And according to Chapter 2, a lot of Beer's initial work in Chile actually had very little to do with technology or even cybernetics, and more to do with just providing emergency basic management consulting advice to a deeply overwhelmed, very young, and inexperienced government. But he did try to at least make sure that his interim recommendations would support and not impede future implementation of a technology-backed cybernetic solution to the management of the national economy, particularly emphasizing stronger communications within the state economy, since that would also be the basis for a cybernetic network. The author of the book, who interviewed Stafford Beer before his death in 2002, argues that the experience of working in Chile, being near the heart of the revolutionary fervor, and seeing it be crushed under the boot heel, quote, profoundly changed him for the rest of his life. Shortly after the coup, he spent a couple of years frantically working his professional networks to evacuate to safety or secure the release of as many of his Chilean colleagues from Project Cybersyn as possible. And then, when he was finished with that, he went from a high-rolling consultant in the London area to a semi-hermit in the Welsh countryside. His writings on cybernetics continued, but took on a far more socially oriented bent. In the mid-1980s, he did make a short-lived attempt to build a similar computer system to Project Cybersyn for the new democratic government of Uruguay, but it didn't get very far, and he also made an even shorter-lived attempt to help a social democratic government in Venezuela. So that's the summary on Stafford Beer, who it's important to understand for the rest of what we're going to be talking about, because he was the guy who was mostly designing this entire system. So getting back to Project Cybersyn, why was it launched and when was it launched? So it was launched about a year into the Allende presidency. Now, that presidency lasted for just under 3 years total before the coup, and the project was undertaken, again, in response to the course of the first year to deal with the struggles of the economic situation, which, of course, had been fomented internally or internationally by the United States. And the technological solution was seen as a creative strategic tool to affect politics by straightening out the economy. And ideally, also, it would have various, you know, political aims that it could achieve as well, beyond just economic fixes. But again, it never really got that far, although they were trying to design it with that in mind from the beginning. The Cybersyn prototype was used to monitor the fall 1972 truck driver's strike being financed by the United States. We will return to that later, but I wanted to note that I linked in the notes at arsenalfordemocracy.com to a 1999 article from The Guardian in the United Kingdom, which was about the U.S. partial declassification of files related to covert U.S. support of military, paramilitary, and economic activities in Chile ahead of the coup, including the 1972 truck driver's strike, which, quote, ratcheted up the sense of chaos and forced Chileans to queue for petrol, food, and medical treatment. Now, Project Cybersyn, when it eventually came to light, was criticized by Allende opponents at home and abroad as a tool of totalitarian control if it became fully operational. But I want to emphasize here before we get into the details of it, that is basically Cold War spin fueled by British tabloids when they got wind of it ahead of a planned public rollout in early 1973. Let's think about what we're actually talking about here in the early 1970s, especially in an economically very small country, under-resourced country like Chile. How could four mainframe computers possibly result in totalitarian surveillance and control, especially with U.S. computer firms pulling out of Chile and participating in the U.S. economic blockade of Chile? The author argues that the project's theoretical view of the concept of, quote, control, as defined by its consulting theoretician Stafford Beer, was, as I said earlier, self-regulation, i.e. not control in the sense of domination, but rather to be in control of itself rather than spinning apart. Control was about adaptive and evolving self-perpetuation of the whole system so that it didn't all break down. This supported the political goals of evolution within the constitutional order, not revolution outside of it. And in fact, Beer's view of exceedingly complex systems, that was his phrase, such as an entire national economy, was not that they should be handled with precise commands, but rather with flexible controls that can absorb in it and work around a wide variety of scenarios and outcomes. Stable equilibriums, like a human body's homeostasis, not the coercive domination of all aspects of life, was the object of this real-time control system in Chile. If something went wrong in one part of the economy, it would not necessarily be advisable or even possible to try to fix that aspect specifically, and it might be better to cover the problem by boosting a different part of the economic system in the meantime until things return to normal in the first area. And if the equilibrium normal in some area was a problem, then that meant there would need to be more structural change to the system to establish a new equilibrium point. Now, the book doesn't actually give an example of this, which I found a little bit strange, because there's lots of other metaphors in the books drawn from various personal papers and interviews. So I tried to think of an example that I think would explain this. So I think we could imagine a one-year crop failure as being an example of something that needs a temporary workaround provided by other sectors, because you can't just demand more crops with a command economy or anything. But a permanent environmental change, by contrast, is going to need a permanent change in the system as a solution. And in a hypothetical example like that, you can also scale it up and down in size with varying solutions. So a localized crop failure, as opposed to a nationwide one, or a permanent localized environmental change could be mitigated by laterally negotiating with other parts of the system to compensate for it in other regions, just like skin self-regulating its own temperature in the human body. By contrast, a nationwide failure or degradation would need a nationwide correction with a more vertical intervention, as if it's someone consciously deciding to put on a sweater. That's the comparison analogy that I came up with while reading this, right? So your body can do some amount of its own self-regulation, but at a certain point, you're going to put on a sweater. And so there's some amount of this that ideally in this cybernetic system, had it been fully realized, you would have been able to, you know, do these lateral or diagonal negotiations across departments to fix a problem, as opposed to needing someone to come in from the top to solve the problem. But sometimes you need that. Now, as another point in favor of the system being very unlike any of the Soviet comparisons that were thrown at it, in terms of totalitarianism or whatever, a concept for a Soviet economic cybernetic system in the 1960s that never came to pass had called for a program to monitor and control 50 million economic variables, which was both an impractical level of control under the philosophy being pursued in Chile and one that was simply not technologically possible with the available computer resources of 4 Chilean mainframes, compared to the thousands of Soviet computers already in service. And it was deemed unrealistic anyway, because under the Soviet concept, what would prevent the local-level managers or even higher-level bureaucrats from simply entering false data to meet arbitrary targets? Additionally, in Chapter 3, it's noted that the system in Chile was actually designed to throw out the data that was considered normal as opposed to anomalous, and that would further avoid any all-seeing eye problems. Now, of course, as we'll discuss later, Project Cybersyn came to a very definitive end with the September 11th, 1973 military coup. So, Rachel, at this point, I want to pause as we're, you know, getting into it with the launch of Project Cybersyn about a year into the Allende administration. And I want to back up and talk a little bit more about the political situation, which the book does go into, to kind of explain what was going on with things in Chile that prompted them to undertake this approach. I mean, they never were able to realize it, but they decided to at least give it a shot.
So as you stated, the Allende administration brought beer in after the first year. So what was happening in the first year of his presidency? So first off, the government was in the process of nationalizing many of Chile's mineral wealth and other resources. So they brought beer in because they wanted to better manage these resources, as well as plan the national economy. So the group that was in at the head of that was the State Development Corporation. And they thought that beer and management cybernetics was the best way to help the Chilean government. So in the first year of Allende's government, many changes were made that put more money in the hands of more workers, which increased their purchasing power and also the popularity of the Popular Unity Party coalition. So GDP increased 7.7%, production increased 13.7%, and consumption increased 11.6%. Allende knew for his socialist programs to succeed, he needed to show that the economy would thrive and also create that base of popular support. So this nationalization process accelerated rapidly. So not only was the government instituting these changes, workers got kind of swept up in the fervor and started seizing factories, and peasant farmers started seizing the land that they were working. There wasn't much guidance happening for these committees that were put in charge of these nationalized industries. And there were a variety of different management styles and approaches that these nationalized committees took. Some operated with a really hands-off approach, and some started managing production quite closely. In addition, the worker-owned factories had to be brought in and managed. So administrative councils were created, which did include some of these blue-collar workers and somewhat allowed them a part of decision-making. Another problem was new state-appointed manager-directors of these nationalized factories or enterprises. while some were certainly dedicated to the work of managing these nationalized enterprises and industries, there were some who were incompetent or even corrupt. Part of this was because of the decision to appoint them equally from all political parties, regardless of competency or knowledge of the industry. So some, especially the Communist Party, complained that these new state managers slash directors simply took the place of greedy and corrupt executive boards. They also got into clashes with union leaders who traditionally performed a leadership role in their factories and had a lot of the knowledge of how to run the factories in the best way. Also, former private sector managers left and often took their institutional knowledge with them. So there was just basically a lot of chaos happening, a lot of turmoil, and this really set the stage for bringing Beer and his cybernetic management process into Chile.
So as you can see, these are the problems that they were trying to address with Project CyberSyn. Unfortunately, many of these problems probably would have also been major impediments to successfully implementing Project CyberSyn. Chapter 3 of the book covers the physical design and engineering of the network. Rachel, do you want to talk about the concept that Beer was offering?
Beer proposed the idea of, quote-unquote, roll-up, an iterative process wherein policies traveled down to the factories from the government and the needs of the factories traveled upward. He positioned management in the middle, where it formed a homeostat that coupled the needs of the lower levels with the resources allocated from above. Government officials could therefore change and adapt government policies to meet the needs of the factories, so long as such changes did not have substantial negative effects on other areas of the economy.
A prototype or demonstration control system was called Project CyberStride, although this eventually came to refer specifically to the software component, and it was supposed to come online by March 1972, just 4 months into the overall Project CyberSyn, which, as you can imagine, was kind of a excessively ambitious timeline in many ways. Rachel, could you describe what the prototype was going to be?
The system would rely on data collected daily from state-controlled industries and would use mainframe technology to make statistical predictions about future economic behavior. The system would update these predictions daily after Chilean computer operators entered the new data arriving from the enterprises.
So communication was key to this system and its concept, and turning data points into responsive action was the immediate objective since the government was already in a sort of permanent crisis state at this point. The hope was that not only would the higher levels of government be able to direct resources to emergencies soon, but that experienced mid-level managers of whole sectors would be able to train the inexperienced factory-level and enterprise-level state managers who were overwhelmed by the new acquisitions of the state. CyberStride would also include software to simulate the Chilean economy so that they could kind of play around with it and see what changes they might want to make things better. The state-controlled National Computer Corporation could offer only one of its four mainframes to the team to design the CyberStride prototype around, and there weren't really many other computers in Chile that could network to that mainframe. The solution that they came up with was to rely on the well-established technology of telex, or teletype machines, that could transmit data and messages over telephone lines. Computer operators at the center of the system would then take this incoming data and manually convert it to inputs for the IBM mainframe on site, although they eventually did begin trying to write some software to interpret the telex data automatically and feed it directly into the mainframe without a human translator, but they never really got that far. The mainframe would run a comparison against previous data to check for significant variations and spit out alerts. The operators would then feed these alerts back into the telex network to transmit them both to the higher level management and back down to the source of variations so that they could confer in both directions. Initially, this idea was also a problem because they only had two telex machines, but it turned out, very fortuitously, that there were 400 unused telex machines in storage at the National Telecommunications Enterprise that had been purchased by the previous Christian Democrats government and left in storage. It was decided that the prototype project would install telex machines in the sectors of textiles, forestry, construction materials, and agro-industry, although only some of this actually happened. As a political objective for the use of the technology, the plan was to use the data feedback from factories to increase total production by increasing worker productivity. but not to eliminate jobs after increasing that productivity. And that is a huge point that is emphasized throughout the book, is that you can see how the political objectives of this system differed substantially from similar capitalist systems being experimented with in terms of early computing at the same time, right? The goal with implementing machines in capitalism was generally to increase worker productivity, not just so you can make additional profits, but so you can shrink your workforce and your labor force. And that's obviously not a goal of a socialist government. So their government goal was, yes, they wanted to increase productivity, but not just by worker, but in total, so that they could continue to maintain higher levels of employment in the country and get their economy sort of more developed over time. Allende personally approved the prototype project in a three-person meeting on November 12, 1971, finding the biological metaphors of cybernetics compared to the human body to be interesting and compelling, given his background as a doctor. Allende specified that the project should be, quote, decentralizing, worker-participative, and anti-bureaucratic, end quote. He also asked whether the system would be incorporating technology or design from the Soviets, and apparently seemed fine with it not doing so. The software coding was partially outsourced to London because there were not enough experienced coders in Chile. Communication between Chile and London was also maintained via a telex connection through the London remote office of Chile's state-owned copper company. The outsourced coders in Britain could not realistically deliver the level of software required by March of 1972 for all the planned sectors, and ended up scaling that back to work on a much smaller demonstration software package. They did, however, incorporate the absolute most cutting-edge statistical modeling concepts being published in 1971 for the first time, which would better identify what kind of data anomaly was being detected and whether or not it was actually an emergency or just noise. One problem the team in Chile realized fairly late in the process was that for any industry they wished to bring into the control system, they would first need to conduct a thorough study of the industry to decide what inputs to record daily and to figure out what a normal data range for each of those inputs would look like, especially tricky during an economically chaotic period. It was emphasized to them by the theorists that it was less important to collect data on everything and more important to collect data on key choke points where things could have a big ripple effect. As the CyberStride software was progressing and the Chilean economic simulator was being modeled and the CyberNet network of telex machines was being installed, planning and work also began on the control center or operations room, which would be finished in November of 1972. Stafford Beer also started imagining a sort of far-fetched idea of reversing the flow of information found in mass media broadcasts by installing a happiness or dissatisfaction meter in every home, where every citizen could register their opinions on how things were going each day, and this data, in the form of rising or falling voltages from these meters, could be aggregated together for the government. But again, done through voltages, so you can't pin down who specifically is doing it. He called this concept Project Cyberfolk. He also imagined a narrower version of that installed in factories, where workers could walk up and register how they were collectively feeling to all their fellow workers and managers. And that could potentially avert strikes by encouraging early intervention to improve conditions. All such meters would be analog and voltage-based to give some amount of anonymity when aggregating the data. The concept was never implemented in Chile, but the book notes it separately came to be used for live cable TV political debate response trackers in the United States, which is kind of funny. It also shows that a lot of the stuff they were discussing here was not particularly, like, crazy. Some of it was cutting edge and advanced technological stuff, but it wasn't totally crazy, conceptually anyway. As U.S. credit dried up and U.S. trade was reduced to a trickle, and as Chilean copper prices declined, inflation was rising rapidly. There was, for example, over the course of 1972, a 180% price growth. And the CyberSyn team was finding that no matter how much work they put into trying to refine their modeling of the Chilean economy, they simply lacked enough data on key metrics to get anything accurate or usable out of the economic model. Gathering data on processes at the factory level required a huge amount of time and research, as well as the cooperation of the manager on site, and all of this could be very tedious and slow. They were instructed to seek the input of the floor workers, but rarely did. The author confirmed this in many of the interviews with the people who conducted that research work on site, and also noted that not a single worker ever got in contact to talk about the project despite extensive outreach efforts while researching the book, suggesting that they were basically never involved in Project Cybersyn at any meaningful level. So kind of contrasting the utopian goals of the project versus the actual implementation of it during its design phase and setting up the prototype. There had been strikes, in fact, in Chile in the 1960s over the growing use of Taylorism practices for management efficiency in Chilean factories. It is likely that if Project Cybersyn hadn't been cut short by the coup, it would have turned into a major point of friction with the workers that it aimed to empower, because they would have viewed this as attempting to introduce more Taylorism into their factories rather than its sort of holistic national level approach that it was attempting to take. Again, this was supposed to be dealing with complex systems in a sort of abstracted way rather than trying to do the Soviet approach of, you know, 50 million economic variables and controlling and fine-tuning each individual one. But people wouldn't have necessarily understood what the objectives were. And of course, as a lot of the book covers, objectives versus reality didn't necessarily line up either. Chapter 4 talks in some details about members of the Chilean government who specialized in industrial design and promotion of new technologies, and how they thought deliberately about the social, cultural, and political ramifications of design and adoption of new technologies. There was an extremely small cadre of recently trained or currently student industrial design and graphic design experts in Chile by the early 1970s, and basically all of them were brought on board to design the space age control room for Project Cybersyn. Many of the industrial designers who became involved in the project had already been working on advancing the goals of the socialist experiment by designing inexpensive mass-market consumer goods that could be produced domestically uniformly, and by designing very precise domestic equipment for use in the agriculture sector and state social welfare programs to feed kids. Now they were tasked, on the side, with designing a cutting-edge, modernist, ergonomic room for a small number of high-level planners and politicians to review real-time economic data visually and work together to make decisions. They came up with a circularly arranged lounge with a new fiberglass design for chairs and screen cabinets. There would be a combination of flat projector screens and imported television monitors on walls in a hexagon around the non-hierarchical circle of seven chairs with buttons built in to control all the screens and data feeds. One wall was dedicated just to alerts about emergencies of various scales. There were no tables, and writing in the room was prohibited because it was believed that they should be verbally discussing decisions and then entering them directly into the computer system. Again, this is the theory behind all of this, which doesn't necessarily make a whole lot of sense in practice, as you can probably tell. There was also an adjoining kitchenette to facilitate a comfortable lounge atmosphere. They believed the visual design and aesthetic of the control room prototype needed to have a certain look to sell the overall project's continuation beyond the demo phase. The lowest tech element in the room was probably the one wall that was just a fabric-covered magnetic board where physical representations of the economy could be moved around during discussions. The designers to this day dispute any inspiration from contemporary science fiction media for the look of the control room, something like Star Trek or 2001 Space Odyssey, instead contending that the heavy use of fiberglass and polyester naturally made it look like that by default, which I suppose is possible. It's also critical to note that at the time, they could not actually use computers to generate almost any of the visual representations, as opposed to numerical representations, that they wanted to depict on the screens in the control room. I found that personally to be a very interesting point, because this is the big area where you can start to see some of the physical and technological limitations that made a lot of people look at this and say, this is a ridiculous project that could never actually work. Certain parts of the project, as we'll talk about, definitely did work, though. Instead, because they couldn't do, you know, computer-generated graphics and charts and things like that, they needed to design how the slides of this data would look graphically. Then they would need to design someone to draw the graph or chart of that day's data, and then they would need to have a photographer physically convert it into something that could be shown on a slide by an overhead projector. As the author notes, quote, although the operations room presented a sleek, futuristic vision of socialist modernity to which an occupant could control the economy with the touch of a button, maintaining this illusion required a tremendous amount of human labor, end quote. Graphic designers and a photographer would have to be updating slides every single day by hand all day if the room ever became operational to the extent envisioned. And I think that's probably analogous today to many of the technology firms promising automation that actually turns out to be provided by remote workers overseas in cheap countries using a camera and remote controlled technology and pretending that it's a robot doing it. Another section from the book in Chapter 7 speculates that, quote, it is highly probable that the amount of human labor required to update the displays of information in the operations room would have created substantial obstacles to its full implementation, end quote. The armchair buttons, in lieu of a keyboard, were supposedly implemented to allow anyone with limited knowledge of computers, from the highest politician to the lowest factory floor worker, to walk into the control room and give a presentation. But the author repeatedly emphasizes that this actually had the practical effect of allowing men who didn't know how to type to use a computer system in the control room without the intervention of a female typist or secretary who did know their way around a keyboard. So there's a big gender dynamic here that was never really explicitly stated, but was clearly in their minds at the time. By July of 1972, the project team was trying to dramatically pick up the pace of their already expedited work, which is on an ambitious timetable to begin with, amid mounting fears that the economic and political situation was deteriorating so fast that it might lead to the fall of the government. They wanted the demonstration prototype of the control room, the network, the software, and the economic model to be ready to show off before the end of October so that they could start making progress on turning things around for Chile. Political battles over the ongoing nationalization, which was also continuing to strain state capacity, was radicalizing the petty bourgeoisie of the owners of small and medium enterprises against the government, convinced that they would be nationalized next, like the big nationwide corporations. The U.S. was, of course, also continuing to finance both right-wing and pseudo-left-wing agitation against Allende and was maintaining its undeclared economic blockade. In August 1972, the government declared a state of emergency in the capital. In September, Allende announced a right-wing military coup had been thwarted. And this brings us to Chapter 5, where we actually see the demonstration of the system to the extent that it existed. In the face of a growing prospect of a military coup, members of the Cybersyn team who were part of the Allende government or its political movement became much more hard-nosed and pragmatic about accepting the limitations of the system as it existed and figuring out how to keep it from being overthrown, although they still wanted to expand it further beyond its demonstration sectors and industries to encompass the entire government as soon as practical. There was an internal debate as to whether or not to make a big national propaganda push in early 1973, announcing the launch of Cybersyn as the system and what it could do. Ultimately, a more cautious approach was preferred amid fears that it would either be viewed as an overblown boondoggle that couldn't deliver on its promises or would generate additional public backlash for trying to change everything in Chile too quickly at every level. But parts of the project were forced into use behind the scenes before the end of 1972, and it ended up becoming very public in early 1973 anyway, contrary to what they had been planning. In October 1972, the month after the foiled coup plot, the aforementioned nationwide truck driver strike began. Now, I think this is interesting to take some time to talk about here, because sometimes you will see people on the internet criticize the Allende government and claim that, you know, he suppressed left-wing workers and strikers and so forth, and that makes him a bad guy who's not a true leftist or whatever, or that he deserved to be overthrown. And in fact, that's not really an accurate understanding of the truck driver strike, which, as we mentioned, was supported by the United States. So this was a strike of 40,000 middle-class, self-employed truckers or small trucking company owners who had a professional association as opposed to a union, and it was accompanied by sympathy closures or lockouts by professional associations representing a range of businesses, and this was purportedly launched in retaliation to the government establishing a state-owned trucking service for underserved rural transportation needs, which they viewed as a direct competitive threat. Since the end of the 1990s, we've known that this strike was directly supported by the U.S., although that wasn't known at the time. This strike was intended to create so much economic gridlock and political instability by means of closing roads and blocking delivery of critical food, fuel, factory raw inputs, and essential goods that the government would resign, be impeached, or be overthrown. Instead, the government decided to use the new Telex network set up to support Project Cybersyn to get real-time data on the strike from one end of the country to the other, a longer distance than across the United States, so that politically loyal engineers and managers could maintain operations at state-owned enterprises with a smaller number of people, start direct delivery services to the public without need of private trucks or stores, and seize control of or reopen shuttered private factories or idle trucks. In a great demonstration of the lateral problem solving that Project CyberSyn hoped for in the first place, although it wasn't really done with Project CyberSyn, many of the factories began trading supplies directly to each other or shuffling them around to cover shortages. The military, with its dubious loyalties, was also deployed in 12 provinces to help reopen the economy by force. And when the strike culminated in a stalemate, Allende was basically compelled to end it by inviting the military into the cabinet with the key portfolios of interior, public works, and mining. This compromise ended the strike, but also strengthened the political and state role of the military, which, of course, the way for that had been paved by, as Rachel said earlier, the assassination of Renee Schneider, who did not want the military interfering with the constitutional order or getting involved in politics. The government as a whole pivoted rhetorically in the face of the strike from saying it merely represented the workers to saying that it would be giving directives to the workers. Although, again, it is worth differentiating that the strikers were not exactly workers in the Marxian sense so much as middle class or petty bourgeois small business owners. In fact, many actual workers found themselves locked out of work by business owners aligning themselves with the Truckers Association, which in turn had enforcers closing down businesses that didn't voluntarily support them. Again, that speaks to U.S. involvement in this. The National Manufacturer Association locked out all its private sector member factory workers, and some businesses even paid workers to stay home. Professional class associations also shut down in support. There was a growing paranoia, justified by reality, among key political figures in the Allende government that had been involved in or running Project CyberSyn, that they were all going to be killed by the right wing in a coup or a counter-revolution, and that the ideals of the project were probably only viable in a peaceful solution that wasn't at risk. So at this point, we start seeing a turn in the project away from its very idealistic origins and things sort of falling apart as we continue to approach the coup, which was coming a year later. Meanwhile, Stafford Beer, remote in London again, was becoming politically radicalized and more idealistic about using cybernetics to not only improve industrial production, but also distribution and consumption to keep the masses happy. And he argued for turning over a fully realized CyberSyn network eventually to workers directly, comparing it to any other piece of automated factory machinery that a worker can learn to use. This was, unfortunately, becoming increasingly detached from reality on the ground in Chile, and certainly did not take into account the political problems this would encounter, even just in terms of basic office politics, to say nothing of the fractious politics of centrist technology workers, hierarchical communist union leaders, and various strands of socialists in the Allende coalition, who all had different views on worker participation in governance and the silos of economic sectors or society as a whole. The government, now fighting for its life, regarded CyberSyn as functionally a collection of tools, like the Telex network, that might help it remain in power, rather than trying to build an idealistic integrated system that could advance revolutionary political and social goals that it had been launched with. In order to keep it alive, the Chilean project leaders began deliberately depoliticizing the entire endeavor to gain buy-in from the centrists and the far right under the new civilian-military combination. They never sought to propagandize or brag about it publicly, as had once been considered. Nevertheless, a core group kept working on developing the project after the October strike, including some of its more idealistic planned elements, and continued that effort into the final year of the government. Chapter 6 covers the disastrous worldwide media coverage ahead of the scheduled public unveiling of Project CyberSyn in early 1973. When it was revealed, it was portrayed by the media as somewhere between a frightening Big Brother machine advancing the Soviet cause or a ridiculous boondoggle in search of government programs to implement, whether worthwhile or not. And when the planned unveiling finally did happen, there was a lot of exaggeration by the people involved in the project, or at least embellishment of what the demonstration prototype, which was of course scaled down from the overall goals, could actually do, as opposed to what it was hoped the finally realized and completed system would have hopefully one day, in theory, been able to do. Some critics attacked it as a literally impossible feat, given what was known about available computing resources in Chile, and that was correct in some ways, but it was wrong in some senses as well, because it misunderstood how the engineers had jury-rigged together what limited resources they had on hand in creative ways that no wealthy country would have ever bothered to try. A month later, in March 1973, the midterm congressional elections actually resulted in a significant decrease in the opposition majority in favor of Allende's coalition, but that only deepened the political impasse because it took off the table the possibility of a soft constitutional coup by supermajority impeachment or even just a veto-proof majority for legislation. On the one hand, the socialists were stunned by this outcome and felt encouraged by the results if they could press on and remain in power for the full presidential term. On the other hand, the political right now desperately felt that they would have to seize power by other means, and a coup became an even greater certainty. Meanwhile, the project still struggled along, facing the same problems as the year before of having insufficient data to run the programs it was supposed to run, or not getting it reported up and down the chain fast enough to be of use. Local level managers were doing the same thing they had done during the trucker strike when they had supply chain problems, which was going in person to other factories or suppliers to negotiate their own solutions and logistics, but they were doing it without the assistance of any computer program because that was too slow. It was hard for the remaining project leaders to persuade others on wider adoption, which would have been necessary to make it work. By April 1973, it was becoming clear that the theoretical basis or philosophical concept of the system was fading away, and only the component technological tools were still of interest, and even these were struggling to serve their narrow purposes regardless of any abandoned big-picture objectives. The politicians had left the project to manage the crisis in the government as a whole, and the less ideologically committed tech workers still involved were not as focused on social revolution via technology. In May 1973, the opposition fomented a strike in the state-owned copper industry, while right-wing terror groups escalated violence so the government was forced to proclaim martial law in the capital. Meanwhile, CyberSyn was slowly continuing to bring more industry enterprises into the Telex network, eventually getting about half of state-owned or state-controlled enterprises by revenue, or a quarter by number, into the system, albeit far too late to help the national crisis. On June 29, 1973, there was an attempted military coup where putsch tanks faced off against constitutionalists within the armed forces. On July 26, the same day as a final meeting between Stafford Beer and President Allende, the right-wing military members assassinated Allende's liaison to the constitutional forces within the military, who had actually been in the meeting with Beer earlier that day. During an August 1973 reprise of the trucker strike from the previous year, the Telex network of CyberSyn swung into action once again to restore as much distribution as possible of vital goods and resources to keep production and consumption from cratering. But by this point, no matter how well the Creative Computer Network was doing on tracking the locations of state-controlled delivery trucks, CyberSyn could do nothing to stop the right-wing paramilitaries and strikers from blockading the trucks, destroying them, or murdering people. Nor could it halt attacks on pipelines and power transmission lines. As late as September 3, 1973, days before the final coup, opposition publications, generally supported with CIA funding, were still hyping up the barely functional demonstration prototype of Project CyberSyn as a totalitarian method of control over all Chilean life by a repressive, radical left-wing government. Around the same time, Allende's inner circle briefly considered moving the operations control center to the presidential palace, perhaps just for easier access to the telex readouts on the emergencies happening all up and down the country, but they never got that far. Ironically, some project members worried that trying to install it in the presidential palace might damage the palace's historic architecture. On the 11th, the Air Force began firing air-to-surface rockets into the presidential palace as the Allende government, the dream of Chilean democratic socialism, and Allende himself met their end. On the 12th, the day after the coup, the leader of Project CyberSyn hastily gathered up four boxes worth of documents on the project and walked out of their building to take them to safekeeping before the troops could arrive. Now, the final thing I want to talk about here as we wrap up this episode are some of the points made in the conclusion chapter. So, the military halted Project CyberSyn's operations, such as they were, immediately. They conducted a brief review to see if there was anything worth keeping, and destroyed most of the system. A system like this would not be necessary, given either a military command model or a neoliberal privatization push under the Chicago Boys. Rachel, can you quote the author's perspective on the overall takeaways on this project?
Given the progress made on Project CyberSyn before the military coup, there is reason to believe that the system was, for the most part, technically feasible and that many, if not most, of its technological components could have reached completion if given more time. But Project CyberSyn was also tied to Chile's peaceful socialist revolution, a political development that clashed with U.S. foreign policy in Latin America during the Cold War. Even if the technological components of Project CyberSyn had reached completion, the system could not have addressed such problems as runaway inflation, lack of foreign credit, falling copper prices, and black market hoarding.
And I think that's to say nothing of the right-wing terrorism and the military plots backed by the CIA, which the author frequently weaves in throughout the narrative. The author also believes that the project would have struggled a great deal with needing huge amounts of training for participants to use it, especially at the factory level, both technically in terms of its potential friction with various power blocks who might be reluctant to adopt it. And the author argues that it was never clear that the people intimately involved in working on this project really understood some of the hurdles at the ground level that they would have to overcome in terms of selling people on adopting this, getting trained on how to use it, etc. So it's an interesting project. As I said, it's one of the big kind of what ifs of, you know, if this experiment had been allowed to survive, you know, could this have helped Chile on its democratic, peaceful, constitutional, socialist path? Or maybe none of it would have worked. Maybe, you know, except for a few of these very specific technological components that were not particularly, you know, idealistic and could be just used for informational purposes, maybe that would have worked and nothing else would have worked. Maybe the whole idea was a boondoggle, as some people suggested it was. It certainly, there's no case you could make that this was going to be some sort of totalitarian system, not just because of how it was designed, but just because of it logistically couldn't possibly cope with the type of thing that people are talking about when they had that in mind. But Rachel, before we wrap up here, I'm just wondering kind of what your thoughts were on this project. Certainly a very interesting and kind of bizarre thing that never really came to fruition, but thought-provoking nonetheless.
Yeah, the word that comes up in my mind is ambitious. It was a very ambitious project. It was really limited by the technology available at the time, as well as definitely external pressure exerted by the U.S. But it's interesting how far they got, even in the face of this opposition and limitations that were in place at that time.
And I also think that it's interesting, especially because this was, you know, a developing economy that was, you know, sort of on the technologically savvier end than most developing nations. And, you know, that helped it transition into developed country status in the post-coup years, unfortunately, in many ways. You know, not saying that as a positive value judgment, just as a description of sort of the economic transition that happened. But, you know, they were having to be creative, and one of the creative solutions in many ways was to keep this very large human component to all elements of this, right? I mean, did you see that similar comparison to what I was talking about with the sort of like tech firms that pretend to be into the AI and automation space and how they kind of use cheap developing nation labor to paper over those?
Yeah, like I guess I didn't realize how little like graphical technology there was back then. It must have been, like you just were so limited by what was available at the time that a lot of human labor actually really had to be put into it and kind of presented as a kind of behind the scenes automated process.
Right. So, you know, the whole thing about like, oh, we need a person to hand draw these graphs and then we need a photographer to turn it into a slide. Like, I would have never thought of that because, of course, you know, I'm born in 1991. That wasn't really a concern. You know, in my childhood, the graphical technology was already sufficiently advanced to be able to do that kind of stuff on the screen. Whereas the television screens they would have been looking at would have pretty much been limited to, like, you know, rows and columns of numbers, I think, for the most part.
Right.
And you would have had to use those overhead projectors for the slides. And the whole thing as well about, like, even just getting the telex data, like, someone had to type in telex data, then it had to go to a computer operator who had to put it into the mainframe. The mainframe ran some number crunching on that and then spat back out some alerts, which then a human person had to figure out what to do with next. Similarly, the whole thing about even just figuring out, which this is like the biggest problem with any sort of data-driven policy or anything, and they understood it, right? I mean, they maybe didn't understand it at the beginning of the project as well as they needed to, but they eventually came to understand it and understood it through a political and socialist lens, which is, I think, not really true of neoliberal technologists and technocrats, is that it takes an enormous amount of human manpower, hours, and brain power and thinking through things at the ground level to figure out what is the data you need to collect to do anything data-driven, right? What are the values that you need to be recording every single day? And then you're going to need to have someone on site recording that data in, you know, because this was not an era where they could automatically connect the input machines at the factory to all the different machines on the factory floor or something like that. You needed to have identified what the data was that you needed to know. You needed to have someone punch that in accurately into the system and get that, you know, logged in and sent off. Then you needed to have someone translate that to the mainframe, etc. And again, the just enormous amount of human labor required to make a system like this work. And of course, a lot of that was especially the case because they were dealing with such a shortage of computing resources that they had to kind of paper over that by using this extensive human labor.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Like, even today, we have massive data inputs available, but it still takes a lot of human discretion and determination to decide what is important and what is actually going to be useful as an input amidst the flood of data. So I guess it's kind of the same problem, but just coming at it from the opposite direction.
Right. And I thought it was also interesting as well that, like, you know, some of the stuff that we might take for granted now in terms of how to, like, more kind of automatically filter out noise, so to speak, from your data, your mass data sets, and just focus on the important signals, so to speak, within that. That's something that was really coming into existence around 1970, 71, 72. Some of that stuff was, like, brand new papers coming out that year in terms of, like, you know, not, and that's not even really about computing. That's just about statistics in general of, like, how do we figure out what's real data versus what's just kind of outlier data without just throwing out data that you're actually going to need. And that's also an interesting point as well, is just the sort of technological limitations of this. You were never going to have a Big Brother system if you were having to throw out enormous amounts of data, because what were you going to do with it? You didn't have the computer resources to do anything with it. You only had the computer resources to save the stuff that was, you know, an anomaly that needed a closer look by a person. And ultimately, at the end of this system was always going to be some person, not a computer, making a value judgment about something. And this book, by the way, again, as I said at the beginning, absolutely worth getting and reading if you can get your hands on a copy of it. It's a little tricky to find. Fascinating lens into the Allende government and its overall sort of democratic socialist project in Chile from this very unusual angle on it. But, you know, you're going to learn as well just, like, about what the kind of limitations of the time period were and things like that. So anyway, I will leave it there. Rachel, thank you so much for being on this week to talk about this.
Glad to be here.